Hello, my name is John Schaefer, and I'm here today with Jonathan Golan, manager of the Man GLG Sterling Corporate Bond Fund. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Where are you seeing the best buying opportunities in credit currently? And do you think opportunities have softened a bit since Q4 last year?
So our investment approach is centered around the concept of the margin of safety. In very simple terms, it means that we seek to buy bonds with yields that greatly exceed the credit risk, so that would be in certain geographies, sectors, and down to the individual security level. Therefore, our view on the market tends to be counter-cyclical. So when yields and spreads are high, we tend to be more aggressive, and conversely, when yields are low and spreads are tight, we tend to be more conservative. Therefore, last year, from the second half of last year, when there was a lot of negativity around fixed income, we've turned very bullish and invested aggressively in the market. And as we go into, as we've gone into 2023, our bullish view has been tamed to some degree, but still seeing very deep value opportunities if you know where to look. And particularly in terms of geography, we're favoring Europe over the United States due to a combination of both fundamentals and valuations. Sector-wise, again, going with the value theme and seeking opportunities where others are quite fearful, we're finding quite a lot of opportunities in European real estate and the financial sector.
And I mean, this is despite the fallout from Credit Suisse, the fallout from SVB, and, you know, property itself has its significant issues recently. Why so positive on that area?
So I would go a step further. It's a result of that volatility. So where other investors may see risks, oftentimes we see opportunity. Whenever there's volatility around a certain sector, we take our investment process, which is seeking bonds that have very attractive yields but solid fundamentals, so companies that have strong cash generation. And then we seek to harvest or exploit the short-term volatility in order to create long-term value. And that's what I've done throughout my career. So if you look to the past, so in 2020, when people were very nervous around leisure-related companies, aviation, etc., that's when we were very bullish. And before that, in 2016, 17, where people were quite reluctant to invest in the UK following the Brexit referendum, that's when we were quite bullish. And then if you go further back than that, you know, around 15, 16, when you had very weak oil prices, we were aggressively in the oil sector. So these sort of things happen time and time again in a timeless way. And from our perspective, that's actually where we as active manager can add a lot of value.
What kind of yields are you expecting at the moment?
So in the investment grade space, within very specific segments of the markets, again, financial, real estate, focusing on Europe, we can generate even double-digit yields. So our fund currently has about 13% yield with a running yield also in around 8-9%, which means that we're paying out very attractive dividends with also the potential for capital growth from this differential between the running yield and the effective yield.
So how far down the credit spectrum do you have to go to that get these kind of punchy yields of 13%?
So we're very much focused on the triple B segment of the market of investment grade, which is very different from how we were positioned when we launched the fund in Man GLG. So when we launched the fund, the market was quite, everyone was very bullish and the market was quite expensive. And therefore, we were focusing more on covered bonds, AAAs, UK government bonds, and cash. And as markets sold off, we've shifted our attention towards BBB, BBB minus, and we can also do some, we can also invest a portion of the fund in high-yield securities up to 20% of net asset value.
So when going for lower credit ratings like that, what's the risk of default?
So one of the things I'm a big believer in is separating the external credit rating from our internal assessment of the credit risk. So we don't invest based on credit letters. We based We invest based on our assessment of the credit risk that is attached to these companies. We have very strict underwriting criteria that are focused on cash generation, specifically metrics that are comparable between companies from different industries. So the key metric that we use is called unlevered free cash flow, which is a measure of the cash generation that is available to service the debt. And we always seek for this number to be in excess of 10%, which means that if we as creditors take over the company, we will enjoy a 10% running yield, real yield, which we think is providing sufficient margin of safety.
You know, one of your holdings is Credit Suisse in, in your Sterling Corporate Bond Fund. You know, why did you invest in that issuance?
So we've made very attractive returns investing in Credit Suisse, and actually it's been one of the a significant contributor to our excess returns relative to our benchmark and our peers. We invested in Credit Suisse in senior bonds there that are now going to be transitioning into UBS, into the combined entity, once that deal is sort of fully consummated. And the reason that we invested in these bonds is because of the deep margin of safety that, that we found in Credit Suisse once the volatility there started. So if you think about the senior bonds in that capital structure, they had credit support or junior securities below that of about 65 billion plus, which provided ample margin of safety for us. And as it turns out, whilst the equity got very minimal remuneration and the junior tier one holders got completely wiped out, the senior holders are protected and are moving into UBS, which is a very creditworthy bank.
Did you have any exposure to the AT1 loans?
Not at all.
Not at all. Why didn't you invest in them?
We saw better risk-reward opportunity in the senior bonds, where we felt that there is an opportunity, depending on the tenor and the currency, there was an opportunity to make between 10 and even 40% at the lows, which was very attractive with what we viewed as very minimal credit risk, given the credit support that you had from the junior creditors and equity.
So inflows into your Sterling Corporate Bond Fund have been particularly high over the past 6 months or so. I mean, you're now sitting around 416 million. That's been piling seemingly a couple of hundred million into the fund recently. Why do you think the strategy is proving so popular?
So I would break it down into two components. I think investors are quite attracted to the consistent performance that I've generated in this strategy over the last seven odd years. So the strategy has outperformed peers and the benchmark every year, irrespective of whether the market went up or down. So people quite like that consistency. And in fact, last year, 2022, which was the worst year for bond markets of the last 50 odd years, it was our best year in terms of relative returns. So I think investors are quite attracted to this, to the fact that we are agnostic to the directionality of markets. So we don't care whether the market goes up or down. Our investment process is designed to operate in both environments. And then secondly, investors are very attracted to the high yield they were able to provide, both in terms of income and effective yield. As I've discussed earlier, that high single-digit running yield and then low double-digit effective yield, which is something that has not been up for grabs or available over the last 15-plus years.
I mean, do you think investor interest can be consistent? Do you think you're going to continue to get those inflows?
I mean, that's sort of always a tricky question to say, but certainly having been in this sector for the past decade, this is the first time that I'm seeing investors not only seeking to go neutral, but even some investors seeking to go overweight bonds. And I'd say that one of my oldest investors, he used to say that they've been underweight fixed income since the 19th century. And all of a sudden, I'm getting calls from them as well that they seek to increase their allocation to bonds. The second element is that the nominal yields that you're now able to achieve in both government bonds and corporate bonds exceeds many people's expectations for long-term inflation, and therefore the possibility of generating attractive real yields with taking, you know, not a lot of principal risk. I think investors are finding that quite alluring.
You talked about relative returns over the past year. I mean, on your marketing material, it says that the fund's aim is to deliver positive performance in various market conditions. I appreciate this isn't an absolute return bond fund in any way, but you know, you did make a 2% loss over a year. Why didn't you make a positive return?
So I think we have several strategies. Each has a different objective. In our total return strategy, so the strategy that aims to be, let's say, more of an all-weather fund, so generate strong total returns in every market environment. There we've actually delivered almost 25% return net of fees over the last 12 months. And in the sterling corporate bond strategy, which is a relative return strategy, my view is that we've been able to preserve capital very well in an environment that is difficult for bonds. So to give you some context, the index that the fund is benchmarked against is down 12%. So we have been able to provide an excess of 10% return relative to that index, which is certainly very strong performance relative to peers, and investors in the fund are quite that I talk to are quite satisfied with that.
Why do you prefer small and medium-sized issuers in the fund?
So our preference is to own the best possible risk-reward opportunities in the market. Sometimes it's large companies, but oftentimes it's medium and small-sized issuers. Whilst they're mid and small-sized issuers, they're large companies in the absolute sense. To achieve an investment-grade rating, you really need to have some scale. And the reason that oftentimes the opportunities, the best risk-reward opportunities, are concentrated in the small and medium-sized issuers is that they oftentimes are overlooked. So they're under-researched. We've got very large players in the fixed income market, but they really concentrate on the largest issuers in the benchmark, and they tend to neglect the small and medium-sized issuers, even though the smaller and medium-sized issuers actually account for the majority of the market in terms of number of issuers.
So you don't believe the risk is greater with these small and medium-sized issuers?
Not inherently. No. Obviously, sometimes it might be the case, but when I look historically, where did we have large blow-ups? Oftentimes, it was actually the large capital structures rather than the smaller capital structures.
Where do you sit on duration currently?
Our main focus is to select individual credits where we find exceptional yield with minimal credit risk, but we also manage our duration actively. And when we think about our duration positioning, we use the same tools that we use for corporate bonds for government bonds. So we think, what is the valuation relative to the risk? And actually, with the move that we've seen in gilt yields, I'm certainly quite constructive on duration and government bonds. At the minute, the market moves every day, but give or take, gilts yield about 4%, even long-dated gilts. And if you're a believer that over the medium term, the Bank of England will achieve its 2% inflation target, which is what I believe in, then
In how long?
So you're offered over the long run. So if you buy 10, 30-year gilts, you're offered 2% real yields, which is attractive historically. So historically, government bonds have provided between 0 and 1% real yield, and now you have a chance of capturing, call it between 1% and 2%.
So fundamentally, are you looking to lock in longer duration?
So we had a conviction long position during the mini budget crisis. Ever since then, we did have a rally in government bonds, so we've tapered that that part of the fund, but we're still overweight duration relative to the benchmark by about 5 to 10%.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on a more severe recessionary environment? I mean, does that factor into your thinking here?
Certainly. I think both drivers of government bonds are now working in conjunction in a favorable way for both government bonds and high-grade credit. So The growth picture, I think, is very weak. Growth, I would say, has surprised to the upside in the first quarter of the year and the last quarter of last year. But when you look at the drivers of growth, I think it's a low-quality beat. So one of the key drivers have been pent-up demand for things like restaurants, hotels. I don't think that is lasting forever, and I don't think it's sustainable in terms of people's personal finances. And the second one has been investing in machinery and equipment, which is driven by tax breaks that have also expired now. So both these tailwinds are, I think, will sort of wane as we go into the next quarter, so that your growth picture is very negative. And then inflation has also peaked, has peaked last year, and I think we will see a continued deceleration. How fast this deceleration is going to happen, you know, I left my crystal ball in the car, but I think the direction of travel is this deceleration.
I mean, it does still seem fairly sticky, though, inflation, and those prolonged high interest rates. I mean, that could be quite detrimental to some of the companies that you're investing in.
So when we lend money to individual companies, we apply very strict stress tests. So I always tell the analysts, the bull case, I don't care about. We're creditors. We only care about downside risk. So we are positioned in companies that can withstand very severe recessions, including our financials book, where we aim to lend to companies that are profitable through the cycle. So even the banks that we lend money to, unless it's a special situation like Credit Suisse, which was more of an investment on the strength of the balance sheet and the credit support, the 99% of the book is in companies where we see profitability through the cycle.
Do you limit the size of the funds you run?
So my goal has always been to deliver industry-leading returns, and the returns that you generate can be impacted by the size of the fund that you manage. So it's certainly something that we have regular milestones that we've set to assess that we can still be deliver industry-leading returns. At the minute, we're running 400, 450-odd million in the sterling corporate bond strategy, which I think is still quite far from our capacity, given that historically I've ran much more money than that in my previous...
What would the capacity limit be on that fund?
So I think we will assess it. We have certain milestones, and we will assess it. It's not a target or a hard cap. We will just assess it and see how the conditions are.
I mean,
in the market.
As a fund manager, that might be deemed as a bit of an easy get up, because you could keep kicking the can down the road on that, couldn't you?
Not necessarily, because we have different funds that operate in different universes, so we're not really incentivized to grow one fund to a degree where it can't operate in a nimble way. I have a track record that, you know, previously I worked in Schroders, and there we did soft close funds, so I do have a good track record of meeting that. The reason I actually don't say a hard number is that it could prove even to be sooner. It doesn't necessarily need to prove to be later than that. So I say it's not, you know, it's more of a ceiling rather than a target.
I mean, with equity funds, normally the reasoning behind fund gating is liquidity fundamentally. Yeah. I mean, is liquidity as much of an issue in fixed income?
I would say that liquidity generally is more of an issue for fixed income funds than equity funds, given that fixed income is an over-the-counter instrument. And therefore, liquidity management is one of the key elements that we manage in the fund, including with the help of our risk team, where we always want to be in a position where we can liquidate a very substantial part of the fund within, you know, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days. So we can meet very large redemptions should they happen.
And is that the primary reason for limiting a size of it?
I think it's more about generating strong returns rather than liquidity, because you can always add very liquid bonds to the fund and grow it indefinitely without compromising. Because the bond market is vast. It's several times fold the size of the equity market.
But as you were mentioning earlier, to get these sort of somewhat punchier opportunities in areas of the corporate bond market.
Exactly. And I think one of the interesting facets now of the corporate bond market is that on the whole, the corporate bond market isn't particularly attractive. So this, the excess spread that you get for the broad market relative to government bond isn't particularly attractive. But then that masks the fact that in several sectors, in several geographies, you're getting not a once-in-a-cycle opportunity, but once-in-a-multiple-cycle opportunity. And you can't capture that with, unlimited amount of capital. You know, the opportunity is available only in a certain amount of capital.
You have a few financials positions in your portfolio. I mean, we've discussed this already. But, I mean, is that a particularly bullish area, considering the contagion we've had in that market recently? Is that going to continue to be a sort of top area for you?
Yeah, so the fund itself is very nimble in the sense that when there is an opportunity in a geography, sector, or individual credit, we seize it, and we tend to be quite aggressive when we see good opportunities. But when that opportunity ceases to be attractive, because valuation have corrected, we will also sell and move on to the next idea. And therefore, some sort of sector positions are there for 3-4 years, and some are there for only 2 months. You know, if we can make money quickly, that's great. But if we can make money slowly, we're happy to do that as well. Specifically on financials, this is the longest or the most... I'd say the most bullish I've been on financials over the last 10 years, mainly due to valuations. But here it's very important to be nuanced. So we're very bullish on European financials, where we don't see fundamental issues. We think Credit Suisse was an outlier rather than a precursor. Whereas in the US, we're very defensive. Mm. So we don't own a single US bank.
Okay.
In our strategy, because we think there's real fragilities there. So that's not a value opportunity, that's a value trap. So Europe is a value...
Is that because of the sort of local bias to sort of these local banks that we saw with the SVB fallout? Or is that a sort of more fundamental issue with some of the more systemic banks?
So is more on the regional bank side than the larger banks. So we think that in all the globally systematic banks, they've reported... for this quarter, and they've actually demonstrated that their deposit franchise is stable, and B, that the asset side of their balance sheet is moving with interest rates, so they haven't locked in as much of their balance sheet in long-dated securities that are now underwater, so they don't have the same issues as the regional ones. But one thing I would say is regional banks are very material for the U.S. economy. So they're really the main outlet for commercial real estate lending, SME lending. This is not done so much by the large banks. And therefore, we see fragilities in the banking sector and also fragilities in the economy. And therefore, we're very much geared towards Europe, where we get better valuations and better fundamentals. So you have your cake and you eat it too. I think that's a good idea.
I mean, what about the likes of Deutsche Bank? Is that a concern for you in Europe?
No, it's not a concern for me in Europe. So we've looked into Deutsche Bank, and I'm not going to opine here whether it's a good bank or a bad bank, but I'm happy to say that it's got very many dissimilarities from Credit Suisse. The first one is that it's profitable. So Credit Suisse was loss-making for the last 2-3 years and also projected 2 more years of losses, which is just too much for I guess, investors and clients to bear, whereas Deutsche Bank has been profitable last 3 years and we expect good profitability this year. Secondly, the deposit franchise is much more robust, being focused mainly in Germany, unlike Credit Suisse, which had a big franchise in APAC, which proved to be much more flighty. So I think the talk around Deutsche Bank is, the rumors of its death have been greatly exaggerated.
We were talking about some of the sectors you were seeing good opportunities in. Are there any sectors that you're avoiding at the moment?
So I think managing a portfolio is always about having the yin and yang. So if you are long financials that inherently they're more cyclical, we are very much underweight and in some cases outright short in non-financial cyclicals, so automakers, consumer goods, capital goods, you know, if it's a company that's making washing machines or that sort of stuff. So yeah. Very, very cyclical companies with typically thin margins and low ability to pass through price rises. We think it's not the right time to be in those.
How much of the Sterling Corporate Bond Fund is in short positions?
Not very much. So that would be high single digit, low teens. Oftentimes, yep. It would be paired with a long as well. So just my psyche is more on the long side, finding value opportunities. And actually, you find that, especially investment grade credit, companies are generally high quality credits, and therefore is not easy to make money from shorting companies.
Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.